I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. In her years as a journalist, author, and cultural critic, her name has graced some of our most revered publications. Pulitzer Prize winner Anna Quinlan joins us today for a discussion about her career and her most recent title, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. In her most recent writing endeavor, she's crafted a memoir that peers into the world of marriage, friendship, faith, and growing older. Some of her insights: a safety net of white lies can be the bedrock of a successful marriage. Real friends offer both hard truths and soft landings. And being a parent is not transactional. We do not get what we give. We're about to get more Quinlan wisdom on Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Columnist and novelist Anna Quinlan is taking stock. Nearing 60, she's assessing life from all sorts of angles and liking what she's seeing. She wouldn't trade where she's at for 25, not at all. She's appreciating friendship, her mother, and even solitude. And she's also appreciating her liberation from all the stuff we tend to surround ourselves with. She is finally at that moment when she knows what matters and what doesn't, and what a cool place that is to be. Anna Quinlan talks about all this in her new book, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. She's written books that have sold in the millions. She's written for Newsweek and the New York Times, with columns Life in the 30s and Public and Private. She's won a Pulitzer, and she's written six novels. And she's only getting started. Anna Quinlan, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Great to be here, Steve. Two newspaper people sitting around talking. What's the world coming to?
Not a bad thing. Yeah. Well, you have a chapter in your new book in which you bemoan this era of uber momism, and you write that we live in a perfection society these days. How did we get started down that path? Because, you know, I guess I'm not sure I see it ending anytime soon.
Honestly, on the mom front, I think a lot of it has to do with the lives of the new woman. You know, every time we get some freedom, somebody finds a way to make it a double-edged sword. And I think a lot of the mom stuff is, okay, you know, you want to work and have these rich, full lives, well, then we're going to professionalize motherhood so that it becomes just another job. And not just another job, but a really, really hard job in which you're not as – if you're not, as they say, present in the moment constantly, it's somehow an epic fail.
Yeah.
I mean, I like to think I had my kids just at the cutting edge, which was – I was the first person who'd been pregnant in the Times newsroom in I don't know how long. So everything I did was sort of making it up as I went along, mm-hmm. including getting a babysitter and deciding how I was going to feed and clothe these kids. And now I look around and, you know, there seems to be a how-to book for every step
Everything.
Of the way. And
yeah.
I think the pressure would have killed me.
Well, who is behind this? Who's the cabal? Who's running the cabal that has made motherhood more difficult once again?
You know, I don't necessarily think it's a cabal. What it is it becomes a slippery slope. I mean, I remember standing on the playground and having moms talk about how their kids were speaking in full sentences at 11 months. and I kept thinking, my son is a dope. Now, it turns out my son is actually on the other end of the continuum from dope. But at that time, I was so intimidated, and I didn't realize the essential fact of motherhood. Everyone lies.
Yeah.
Everyone
yeah.
lies about what their kid can do. Everyone yeah. lies about what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. now, of course, I know that, and I'll be able to pass it on to my children when they have children themselves.
Well, don't you write in here that your son used to sit in the playground and sort of just sit there and stare at his hands and
you would wonder what's
wrong here?
My oldest son did not walk until he was almost 2 years old. And mm-hmm. as I say in the book, I was given the business cards of many fine pediatric neurologists at various times during that second year. And I thought of that so poignantly when my son moved to Beijing and lived there for 4 years working for Newsweek. Mm-hmm. I thought, be careful what you wish for. Not only can he walk, he can get on a plane and he can fly away.
Yeah, look at that. You know, well, sometimes just as a joke on the playground, I would, you know, with people I know, I would go up to moms with their little kids and I would say, well, how's he doing? We'd be talking. And, well, is he doing the math thing yet? Does he have that down? Just sort of joking around. And people, they get all nervous, you know. Well, if she's not doing that yet, maybe she should be. I'm just kidding.
But it's really hard for people to be chill about their kids. And, you know, there's the two kinds of not chill moms. There's the one who's working outside the home for pay, who feels like she has to professionalize being a mother to show that it's every bit as mm-hmm. important as her paying job. Mm-hmm. And there's the ones who aren't working outside the home for pay, who feel like they have to professionalize it because if they're giving up such great opportunities
in the
world,
good at being a mom.
It better be an Uber job.
Yeah. Well, do you ever see the pendulum swinging back and maybe society will begin to sort of come back down to earth on all this stuff?
Well, I hope it does. And the other thing I hope is we're talking about mom. Most of these children actually have two functioning parents. And I hope that we are approaching a generation in which the dads will step up every bit as much as the moms do. I hate to have to say this, but maybe that's what's going to change things because mm-hmm. I do find that the dads who are involved are a little more chill, perhaps mm-hmm. because they have so much less to prove than we do.
Well, to what extent do you think that dads have stepped up to the plate?
I think it's a lot better than it used to be.
Yeah.
On the other hand, my husband sometimes used to say, I do so much more than my father did. And
I've used that line before.
And I will come back to you with the line I use with my husband. Zero times any number is zero, dude. No, I mean, I think dads definitely do more. I also still think that we act as though a guy who takes care of his own kids has invented fire.
Yeah.
Hello, let's stop doing that.
We deserve extra credit somehow from the guys, yeah. Well, is there a consequence that our kids are paying for this intensive focus that they're getting from moms and dads?
Yeah, I mean, everybody complains that they don't grow up as quickly as we did. Why would they when every aspect of their life has been maintained? But here's the thing that I find really unfortunate. So let's say you have a kid applying to college and you oversee which SATs they take and you edit their essay, which basically means you write it, okay? And then the kid gets in. Does the kid feel a sense of accomplishment?
Yeah.
Not really. And so if we do all this stuff for our kids, they don't get that sense of autonomy and accomplishment that's so important.
Now you mentioned this in this book, that spate of stories that came out a few years ago of parents actually showing up for their sons or daughters' job interviews, which, again, it's just incredible to me. Astonishing.
I have to tell you, though, a couple of dinner parties, I mentioned how wacky I found that, and there were long silences around the table.
Wow.
And I suddenly realized I was sitting with people who had done that. The problem for me is I did a lot of the hiring at the New York Times when I was deputy metro editor. If any young person had ever shown up with a parent in tow, I would have knocked them off my list
right away.
Immediately.
You know, well, in this book, we're talking with Anna Quinlan, her new book, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. You spend a lot of time looking back and reflecting. And one conclusion you've reached, Anna, is that you wouldn't be 25 again to save your life and you wouldn't be 40 again either. Why not?
I just feel like I've learned so much stuff over the course of my life and that it serves me in such good stead that I'm not taken in by sort of our societal scams of this is the way you should be and this is the way you should look and act.
Yeah.
My kids are launched in a really good way. I still have all the same friends I've always had and now I have much more time to get together with them. I know how to do what I do for a living, and I know where it fits in the continuum. So I sort of feel easy in a way I definitely didn't do at 25. And I felt less when I was 40.
You're making me jealous.
Well,
I'm still working on the kids.
That is, you know, part of the blessing. I have to say, a lot of moms in their 30s and 40s have said to me, gosh, I read this chapter on girlfriends in your book, and you're right. My girlfriends are sort of the bedrock of my existence, but I don't get to see them as much as I'd like because there's the kids and there's t-ball and there's soccer and there's my job. And I keep saying to them, just wait, because all that was true of me too. I mean, I would think, oh my God, I haven't talked to so-and-so in 3 weeks because of the press of events. But life gets easier in those ways.
You have three children. When your third was getting to the point of fleeing the nest, were you looking forward to that moment or were you dreading that moment?
Well, actually, I find the empty nest a little bit of a mythical construct. And it might be because we live in New York City. So what would happen with each of ours is they would flee the nest and then somehow – you know, like a boomerang, they would come circling back. So by the time Maria left for college, Quinn actually was in Beijing, but it looked like Christopher was going to graduate and come right back to New York. And in fact, that's what he did. So there hasn't been so much time when there wasn't one of them around.
Yeah. What do you make of sort of the world that awaits your kids these days? Because in a way, I'm sort of glad that my kids aren't close to entering the job market, given how horrible all of that is. What do you make of the world that they're walking into these days?
I'm hugely bullish about it and hugely bearish about it. I mean, the job situation is really disconcerting. Yeah. And I see so many of my kids' friends who are just fantastic people really stymied. And that's one of the things that we have to think about as we baby boomers age. I mean, we all pat ourselves on the back and say, I'm never going to retire. I love my work. Except that we are the first generation to really do that en masse, and it creates a huge bottleneck for young people. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we don't leave, there aren't jobs opening up. The pipeline is clogged. And that concerns me.
And we ain't going to be leaving for a while. I keep thinking I've got a long way to go before I can even think about that.
Well, we've got people who can't afford to leave. Mm-hmm. And we've got people who don't want to leave. I mean, I don't want to stop working.
Why not? You've done it.
It's what I do. Yeah. I mean, it just maybe it's because I'm a writer, and of course a writer has complete control over her own schedule. It's not like some of my friends who have to go into an office every day and be there, say, for 10 or 12 hours.
Yeah.
I can do as much or as little of my work as I want on any given day, but I don't really think of being a writer as what I do. I think of it as who I am.
Mm-hmm. Are you self-disciplined enough to do what you sort of have to do every day, or how does that work for you?
I have a lot of rituals I do every morning, so I won't write because I really hate to write. I hate to write.
Really?
I really hate to write. I genuinely hate it.
Wait, stop the press. Anna Quinlan hates to write.
I actually wrote that in a column in the Wall Street Journal not long ago. It was the first sentence. I hate to write.
Why?
Because there's always this disconnect between what you imagine in your mind and what actually winds up on the computer screen.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? Why is that? Because you start out, you're thinking, I'm going here, and you know where you're going, and suddenly you're not going there. You're
not only do you know where you're going, it has this kind of perfection that's so fabulous. You know, you're walking along and you think, character dialogue, oh, this is really going to be good. And then you start working on it at the computer and you're like, the magic is gone. How has that happened?
No, we just had John Grisham on, and he was saying, in one of those moments that just absolutely stopped me, that when he's into a book, even he, at this point in his stellar career, finds himself sitting there thinking, boy, is this book good enough? Am I living up to my own expectations? Is this book going to be good enough for my readers? And even he deals with that writerly self-doubt that descends on all of us so often.
But
know?
Writing, one of the things you have to try to explain to young people who are trying to write is that the scariest thing about writing isn't the writing. It's the judgment. It's the confidence. Because writing is a process of judgment. I mean, I have sat at tables in bookstores when someone walked up, picked up one of my books, read the flap copy, closed it, and put it back on the pile.
Oh.
You don't get judgment that's much more visceral than that. And that's the thing that I think you have to overcome each time. It's not the putting the words together. It's that little voice that says, this is not good enough.
Hey, how did you make the transition from being, you know, a sort of hardcore daily journalist to novelist now, six books? Why did you make that transition?
Actually, originally I wanted to be a novelist when I was in high school and college. And I couldn't figure out how one was a novelist and actually had a paycheck. And it turns out that it doesn't happen.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's very peripatetic. And I had been the editor of my high school newspaper, and I persuaded my local daily that they should hire me for the summer as a copy girl. And I found out what so many of us have found out, which is newspaper newsrooms are the best place on earth, and being a general assignment reporter is cooler than anything else. And I just stayed and stayed and stayed because I liked it so much.
We're visiting with Anna Quinlan. Her new book, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. She'll be speaking tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. To reserve a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. Again, 913-384-3126. And here's another phone number for you if you want to join our conversation right now, 816-235-2888. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. How did you get involved? You mentioned you were a copy girl for a while, and then you wound up at the New York Times. How did all that happen? How can I do that myself?
It's actually pretty simple, and unfortunately, you're not going to be able to do it the way I did it,
I think
it,
I know
Steve,
the answer to this, yeah.
Which was six women brought a class action suit against the New York Times, charging, quite correctly, that they didn't hire, pay, or promote women in parity with men.
Yeah.
I was working as a reporter at the New York Post, which, by the way, was a fantastic place to start. Love those tabloids.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about having a good time. And I got hired at the Times when I was in my early 20s.
In response to the suit.
Yes, almost entirely in response to the suit. I like to think I was good at what I did, but the New York Times was not in the habit of hiring 20-something young women who were working on tabloids before that suit was settled.
How were you received when you first got started there?
You know, newspaper men are they're such a great group. you know, there were guys who would give me a hard time, but I don't even want to call it a hard time. There are guys who would like make cracks or, you know, joke around with me and everything. There was alcohol drunk at breakfast time. There was all, and you know, I was pretty easy with the whole thing. My impression of newspaper men then and now is that if you can cut the mustard on deadline, after a while, they get used to you. And that was exactly what happened.
Well, when's the last time you were in the New York Times newsroom? It's in a different place now, I know, from where you started. But
I haven't been in the newsroom since the Times moved to the new building. I've been in the Times building for various things, but I haven't actually been in the newsroom.
I just wonder to what extent it's changed, if you would find it a different kind of environment. Like our newsroom at the Star, is, everyone says, sort of like an insurance office these days, so different than what it was. You know, it's carpeted, it's quiet, it's not what it was 20 years ago.
Well, actually, I just was in the Chicago Tribune newsroom. I was doing an event at the Trib, and they said, you wouldn't want to go to the newsroom, would you? And I said, heck yes, I would. And the truth is, the whole cubicle carpeting thing, which I completely decry, started when I was still at the Times. But there's still something about newspaper newsrooms that just – I mean, I walked past a guy who had a headset on, and I heard him say, well, tell him I've got to get some kind of comment from him before the close,
yeah.
Or I'm going to go with what I have. And I thought, yes, I love the
That's
business.
You're home again. Anna Quillen's our guest. Let's go to some phone calls here. Rita from Kansas City, Missouri. Rita, you're on Up to Date with Anna Quinlan. Good morning. You there, Rita? Let's go to Nathan from Leawood. Nathan, you're on the air. Hi, Nathan. You there? I wonder if we might be having trouble with our phones. If we are, we'll get on it right away. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. So you were, as you mentioned, a general assignment reporter early on. What kinds of stories did you cover?
Oh, you know, my first story at the New York Times was a day story. There's one that'll win you a Pulitzer.
What does that mean, a day story?
A day story is about, let's say, the hottest day of the year or the big snowfall. And this one was about Valentine's Day. And instead of using bullets between the sections of the story, they used hearts in between the sections of the story. And I felt very lucky.
Was it a good story?
Yeah, it was a pretty
good
story.
Down your pipe pretty
it was well. Actually a pretty good story. I mean, you know, I was a dab hand with a feature early on. The thing that I had to show my editors to move forward at the paper was that I could do hard news too. So I did 2 years in the City Hall Bureau, the first 2 years of the Koch administration.
It didn't take you very long to wind up as an editor, right? You were, as you mentioned, assistant deputy metropolitan editor, 6 years in? That happened pretty quickly.
Yeah, I guess that was right. I guess that was right. Again, going back to the women's suit, at a certain point, I was kind of designated the woman, you know, the woman most likely to whatever. And so I moved along pretty quickly. I'm not saying that suggesting that I wasn't good at my work, because I was, but there's no question that my sex played some role early on because there just weren't that many women at the paper.
Yeah. Let's try this again here and see if we're up. Alan from Kansas City, Missouri. Alan, are you there?
I am here.
I'm glad you're there. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning to you. I'd kind of like to backtrack, if it's all right, and make a couple comments, one about the retirement and one earlier about you know, raising a family, a dad raising a family, or
right.
So forth and so on. First, my comment about retirement. I'm a professional actor here in town, and I'm in my 60s, and I feel like a writer and an actor that there really is no retirement age in our chosen professions. I don't believe. I believe as an actor, as long as I can walk and talk, and, you know, I'm hired by companies to do that sort of thing, I'm good. And even if I can't walk anymore, I'll get a walker or a wheelchair and go for those roles, you know. And so I don't think, especially in this day and age, that in any real chosen profession, whether it's a carpenter or whatever, that as long as physically you can do it, you can do it.
Right.
So my other comment was about raising children. All my children are grown. And when I got married late in life. I got married at 35. And in the process had three children. Well, I decided to give up my chosen profession and, you know, get a day job.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turned out, my day job was – got me off at like 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and my wife had a night job. So I did that for several years, and once the children got grown. So what that meant was that when I got home from work, I did all the chauffeuring, you know, and the cooking of dinner and all that. And I didn't think twice about it. I thought, well, this is what dads do. It's nothing special. It's just what parents do,
right,
you know.
Right, right.
So that was the only thing I wanted to say, Ms. Quinlan. I enjoy your books. I enjoy this show.
Alan, thank you for calling in. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Rita from Kansas City, Missouri. Rita, you're on up today. Good morning.
Good morning. Ms. Quinlan, I have to say I enjoy your columns, your books. You have been always an inspiration in my life to look forward to what to read and how to proceed further.
Thank you very much.
And I have a comment about motherhood. I have 2 grown-up adult daughters, and I always felt that society today puts too much pressure on moms to be perfect. But we are losing a side that it's not only mom, it's not only dad, but the teachers, the coaches, the neighbors. It's a community that plays roles in raising a child into an adult. And none of the mothers of today's generation should yield in to that pressure. What do you feel about it?
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, I was appalled when Hillary Clinton published her book, It Takes a Village, that there were people who suggested that that title alone suggested that she was a socialist, a term that we have come to throw around willy-nilly now.
Yeah.
I mean, the truth is it does take a village. And the more people that kids are exposed to and that love them and care for them, I think the better off they are. There's a wonderful quote from the sociologist Jesse Bernard, who talks about motherhood and says, the current model in which a mom in her home takes care of her kids in isolation is not only not a good model, it has never been the model throughout history until the last 50 years. And I just think, the more your kids are out and about, the better off it is.
And another comment I have is about retirement. I'm a 62-year-old person who has chosen to retire. And my own feeling is that, yes, there is a purpose in life, and I had a purpose to work until I put my kids through college and stuff. Now it is time for me to spend some time giving myself to the community where I can spend my time giving it to other kids who need in many different ways, as a museum docent or as a naturalist. And I think a lot of people need to think through that how much money do we need?
Yeah.
I'm so glad that you made that point, because I do think we have that old model of retirement in which you leave your work and you basically, watch talk shows in the afternoon and golf and so on and so forth. And the truth is, the extent to which our kids have been involved in community service, they're the most philanthropic generation far,
yes.
Should be a model for all of us in terms of how we could have a different kind of retirement than past generations and serve the community.
You get the thank you, Rita. You get the impression that that's changing, that there is a higher recognition. There's more organizations out there now. We've had some of them in here over the years who set seniors up to be in a contributing mode and help people in different ways.
There's no question about that, and I think more of us need to be open to it. My point about retirement is not that people in their 60s or in 70s aren't capable of still working. It's that we create a problem for people in their 20s and 30s. I mean, the way I got a reporting job in part was because someone turned 65 and left his.
Yeah.
And to the extent that we're not cycling out of the workplace at 65 or even 70 or 75, that means that there is not a job available for someone in their 20s and 30s. I totally understand if people don't want to be altruistic, but that is the case.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Anna Quinlan. Again, you can see her and hear her tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. To reserve a seat, call Rainy Day Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. Her new book, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. We'll talk politics in our second half and a whole bunch more. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed last Friday's visit from the DVD Gurus and our conversation about anti-heroes and movies, you'll find that show and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow, the political pundits return to examine the state with the most conservative congressional delegation in the country. Yep, that would be Kansas. This hour, visiting with Anna Quinlan. She has a new book out, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. You can join our conversation now, 816-235-2888. Our email address, UpToDate@kcur.org. Well, Anna, speaking of political pundits coming in here, Romney, Obama, how's it shaking out to you as you look across the country?
I think the president's going to be reelected. I've been saying that from the very beginning. I think, the Republicans do this thing over and over again. They say to themselves, who's next? Who's next? Mm-hmm. Bob Dole. Who's next?
Right.
John McCain.
Right.
Who's next? Mitt Romney. And when they ask themselves who's next, they get a candidate who's really vulnerable and who doesn't excite even their own people. And I think that's the case with Governor Romney.
But boy, the polls are starting to close, and I think you might be right, but I think Mitt's been sort of written off by the pundit class to one degree or another, and I still think it's going to be close. I think it's going to be real close.
See, I don't see it that way. And the other thing about the polls right now is we haven't started a general election
That's
yet.
Right. That's
and
right.
And what everybody seems to have forgotten is no matter what you think of how the president has governed, he runs – such a great campaign, and he is such a terrific speaker and campaigner. Yeah. And conversely, I think Governor Romney is going to be so vulnerable. I mean, if I were putting together commercials, all I'd do is pull his commercials from the Massachusetts governor's race, in which he says one thing, and put him right up against the clips from those debates in which he says something that's a 180. I just don't think people like that.
Do you think Obama deserves a second term?
There certainly is a lot of the first term that I was disappointed in, although I've got a daughter who's still on our health care plan because of Obamacare. People seem to have really forgotten or not processed the fact that the reason you can keep your up to 26-year-old on your own insurance plan is because of Obamacare. But I think the president has stood really firm on some issues I care about, particularly the funding of Planned Parenthood.
Mm-hmm. You're on the national board.
I am on the national board. And he stood up for women, the equal pay for equal work legislation that he signed. If I had to fault him on one thing, it's something that in the abstract sounds like a positive. His constant attempts to be bipartisan, his constant attempts to reach across to people who clearly were only interested in his personal destruction.
And won't reach back.
Yeah. I mean, he would move over to their point of view and they would change their point of view because they weren't willing to accept anything that was embraced by the president.
You get the impression that maybe he recognizes that now and is sort of done with that.
Oh, I think he does. But I think he wasted at least a year trying to talk to Boehner and Mitch McConnell and wasting his time, frankly.
What else disappointed you about his first term?
Well, on the health care plan, I was a big fan of the single payer plan. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of astonishing that the United States can't manage this when virtually every other developed nation on the face of the earth has and actually really likes it and finds that it really works. So I would say that that was probably job one for me. But on his Supreme Court appointments, couldn't be happier. And ditto some of the stuff he's done for women.
Cynthia from Prairie Village, you're on Up to Date. Cynthia, good morning.
Good morning. I've always had an issue with when people refer to the poll.
Right.
They don't quantify as to how many people were questioned over what time period in what part of the country. Makes it gives extra credibility that may not be deserved. Do you think there might come a time when the New York Times might set a standard to be, I guess, a more aggressive in that description?
Yeah, I think that's a problem, too. And it not only is a problem in the ways that you're mentioning, but it's a problem in terms of the veracity of the respondents. I mean, we have what we in New York call the Dinkins effect and what people in L.A. call the Bradley effect. Yeah. If you had looked at the polls on Election Day when David Dinkins was running for mayor the second time, you would have thought he was going to win. And what we found after the fact was that it was highly probable that people lied about supporting him because they felt they would be seen as racist, given the fact that he was African-American, if they didn't say that.
Mm-hmm. Are we past that now?
I don't know if we're past that. Mm-hmm. What I do know is there are polls and there are polls. You know,
couldn't it be like a standard saying that you can't have airway space or print space if you don't quantify who did the surveys and how many people were surveyed?
Well, actually, the New York Times almost always does that in a polling story. But I still think that's just the tip of the iceberg. New polling organizations have grown up over the last couple of years, specifically PPP, which has a lot of traction because it doesn't seem to be weighted in one direction or another. And I think you're going to see more, particularly with what tech can do with polling.
You know, Cynthia, there's a website called realclearpolitics.com mm-hmm. that sort of compiles a number of polls, the more recent polls, and then gets it, puts them on an average, you know, so you can figure out what four or five polls are saying on average, and that might help cut through some of the concerns you have.
One other thing, my sister works at the New York Times. Hmm. Her name is Vanessa Gordon. She's one of the editors. Uh-huh. Have you ever crossed paths?
I have not, but I've been out of the newsroom for a long time, so there's lots of great new people that I haven't actually met.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Bye.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to your own career. Well, actually, before we do that, you mentioned you're on the board of National Planned Parenthood, and you spent a lot of time worrying about Kansas and all the money being spent out there. How's that been for you?
Well, it's not just Kansas. There's a lot of battles that we've had to fight. We had to mobilize for the Mississippi Personhood Amendment, which suggested that fetuses were people. But given how Mississippi spends money on education and early childhood care, little kids are not. And, frankly, it's money wasted that we could be putting into patient care. I mean, mm-hmm. we provide the lion's share of health care for poor women and kids. So many American women got their first pap test at a Planned Parenthood center. So many women now are having breast exams at them. And it just breaks my heart that when, for example, the state of Kansas decides to go on a fishing expedition through people's medical records, that we have to spend tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars on that when we could be using it to serve the community.
So in so many cases, you're saying the unborn seem to take precedence over the living.
Oh, no question about it. I mean,
why is that?
Over and over again in states where this fight is being fought, I see, a level of literacy, a level of care for particularly poor kids that's really substandard. And I think it's because, the unborn in theory can be sanctified, but poor little kids have actual needs, like they need food and they need shoes and they need decent places to stay while their moms go to work.
And what do you make of that? I mean is that ever going to change?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, it is going to change because I hate to our last caller's point, to go to polling. But if you look at polling on some of these so-called hot-button social issues, gay marriage, abortion, the greatest opposition is from people over 60.
Mm-hmm.
And the greatest support for tolerance and freedom is for people under 30. So the truth of the matter is, when my kids are 60 – the idea that gay marriage would have ever been a hot button issue is going to seem laughable to them. And maybe it will be the same with abortion.
You know, along similar lines, there's still this enormous gender gap in this country. You look at every poll for Obama, for Romney, Obama doing so much better, 10, 13 points better among women, Romney doing better among white males. What do you make of that?
Oh, I mean, come on. White guys are the official group in the main of the status quo, because like the past was really good to them. I mean, 50 or 60 years ago, they got 100% of the pie. Now they only get 70% of the pie. So that progress, change takes away something from them.
Mm-hmm.
The good old days were really good for them. And I think, you see some of them mired deeply in that. And the Republican Party, unfortunately, has become the official party of the good old days.
Anna Quinlan's our guest. Her new book, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. She speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For more information or to reserve a seat, 913-384-3126. And our phone number here, 816-235-2888. And our email address, update@kcur.org. Now, how did you go from being a deputy metro editor at the Times to actually writing a column? How did that transition take place?
Actually, I had two little boys in 2 years.
After staying for so many years, you didn't want to have a kid.
Right. I went on one maternity leave. I came back after 6 months, and 3 months later, I was pregnant again. And I realized that while I could do the job with two little boys at home, I didn't want to. I didn't want to be out of the house that much. And I quit the paper, and then the executive editor, Abe Rosenthal, came up with a plan for me to keep one foot in the door because he was hoping I would get over all this motherhood craziness. And that was to write a column called Life in the 30s, which appeared once a week and was about, as he said, what my friends and I were talking about on the telephone.
And you were able to reach out and connect with women in a way that was significant, and the Times hadn't done anything like that up to that point. What kind of hit was it?
It was completely aberrational. I've got to tell you, Steve, I think Abe and I both thought no one was going to read it. Who cared about this woman, you know, riding around in her Chevy Blazer with the radio blasting so that she could get some privacy? And then it turned out that there were a lot of us, and the mail started to come in, and it, for a time, it was kind of a phenomenon that the great gray lady was, you know, running the young new mother.
Yeah. And so it took off.
Pretty quickly. It really took off. Just the mail, the response we got, it was syndicated all over the country. When I quit that column because my water broke and I gave birth to Maria, the chairman of the Times Company asked me if when I came back after taking a year off, because by then I had three children under the age of five, if I would become an op-ed page columnist, and I did and became the only woman on the page.
Well, what was it like for you when Life in the 30s took off in the way it did? I'm wondering how gratifying it was, too, because so many women, you know, telling you they've ripped out your latest column and put it on the refrigerator, that was sort of the badge of honor in so many ways if a column actually made it to the refrigerator door.
It was fantastic because, like so many other women, here I was in my house with these two little boys feeling as though my brain was turning to mush, going to the bathroom just so I could get 2 minutes by myself, which of course never lasted because they always came knocking at the door. And it made me feel as though I was having a conversation with all these people I had never met. And when they responded so viscerally, it was as though I had a friendship circle out there that we weren't all in our own little worlds with these little kids, that there was a connection between us.
What kinds of columns would connect the most? Was there a certain type that would sort of really reach out and grab people?
Yeah. My third column was about my mother dying when I was 19. And to this day, women will approach me. That was so many years ago. It was almost 25 years ago. Women will approach me with a yellow copy of that column and say to me, look, you know, I still have this.
That really turned your life upside down because you were the eldest in your own clan. You ended up raising your family at an age that's – you're sort of an age when you want to sort of take off and move out on your own, right?
Well, that gives me too much credit. I will say that I took care of them for a year with ill will and not always very well. but it did sort of turn me into an adult virtually overnight.
And an adult who didn't want to have her own kids for a long time. You didn't want to go there.
Yeah, because of that. I mean, I was overseeing four kids between the ages of 9 and 17 who were not in a good place, and that was challenging.
Why did it change? Because it changed very, very, very quickly.
I have no idea. Honestly, I'm as baffled as anybody else, but at 30 I woke up one day and said, oh, let's have children, which of course completely baffled my husband.
Who wanted to take a little bit of time to think about this because as some men do, they want to sit back and think a little bit about things like that.
He's a much more thoughtful and methodical person than I am. I have hair trigger responses to virtually everything.
And you wanted to go right now, and shortly afterwards you did.
Exactly.
Yeah. And at the Times, how did the Times react to that?
The first time around, the Times was great about it, although I was deputy metro editor. Mm-hmm. And by the end, when I was pretty enormous, if I just breathed hard in a page one meeting, I could get almost any story out front. They were kind of worried that I was going to drop that baby in the newsroom.
Anna Quillen's our guest. She's written for Newsweek for the New York Times. She has a new book out, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. You know, one of the chapters of this book that I really enjoyed centered on what you call the what-if game that people play in their heads sometimes. You know, for instance, what if you had gone to a different college? You wouldn't have met your husband. You know, what do you make of that, you know, Anna, this sort of the serendipity of life? Because would you have married if you had gone to a different college?
Well, it's so interesting to me because so many times I've been asked how I planned all this. And the answer is, oh, my God, it never even came close to that. In fact, if I had been coming up with a plan, the plan would have been so much less interesting than the reality has been. I mean, picture me at 25 being a general assignment reporter at the time saying, by the time I'm 40, my plan is to have an op-ed page column and win the Pulitzer Prize. Who would have ever thought to do that? And of course, at 25, I would have said, and by the way, I won't have any children, so I won't have to deal with that complication. I just feel like so much of what happens is accidental. And the key is to ride the accident, to not say, oh, well, I didn't plan for that, and therefore I'm not going to do it. I'm going to fight it. But to understand how much sort of happens through what you correctly called serendipity.
Yeah, I mean, what do you make of that? I mean, there's so much of that in our lives then. It can kind of freak you out if you think about it too much.
Well, I do wonder if people were more open to it, say, 150 years ago, because so much was not under their control. I mean, you know, there weren't vaccines. There weren't airplanes. If you wanted to go to London, you had to sit on a boat for, you know, 2 weeks. If a child got smallpox, for example, you assumed the child would die, as so many children did. And I think now we have this kind of illusion of control, you know, between seatbelts and, you know, life coaches. There's a sense that somehow we can shape our lives. And we're not only less open to serendipity, we are totally freaked by it.
That's interesting. You know, you have a different chapter in your book where you deal pretty openly about your own struggles with drinking. And what struck me about it is that you just decided one day to walk away from it. And it sort of reminded me a little bit of George W. Bush. How did you arrive at that point in your life?
The specific moment was when I was in a doctor's office and I was taking a test in a women's magazine that said, do you have a drinking problem? And I think I took three questions and then thought, if you're even taking this test, then it means that you need to stop.
Why did you want to stop? So why were you so certain you had to stop at that point?
I mean, I had three little kids. I knew that I could go for long periods of time without drinking because I hadn't had anything to drink during any of my pregnancies, obviously. And I started to think about how people are when they drink. Most people, not just me, they're sort of variable. You know, first they're kind of who they are, and then they're a happier version of who they are, and then they're a crabbier version of who they are. And I just kept thinking about the fact that kids, more than anything else, need consistency. And then it was hard enough to be the mother of three little kids. I couldn't afford to be all over the map. And at that moment, I just thought, no mas.
A Heineken was your last drink.
It was. I never miss alcohol. I never think about it, except that every once in a while when I have Mexican food, I think, I like beer with Mexican food, but I haven't liked beer with Mexican food for 23 years.
But you wouldn't even do it for one beer with Mexican food now.
Oh, never. No, I mean, just, why? I mean, I'm a kind of an all or nothing person.
The kids are gone.
Yeah, but I'm a kind of an all or nothing person. And what I always say is, you know, nobody ever had a triple latte and crashed their car. But, you know, once you stop drinking, you're so aware of the damage it does. The big damage and then the little damage. The people that you know who at 30 were sort of considered cute when they drank and who at 60 are considered old drunks. Yeah. And that ain't a good thing.
Yeah. Back to some calls. Judy from Kansas City, Missouri. You there, Judy?
Hey, Steve. It's Judy here. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on Anna's first column about when women in their 30s, can't remember the name of it, but when she talks about kind of like a support group for women, and now that's what I see with Mom to Mom and blogs and Facebook, it's the same kind of connecting to share your concerns, sometimes to brag, but usually just to share your concerns. So we're still at it.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, one of the mommy bloggers tells me that she considers me the first mommy blogger. And I always feel really, really thrilled by that, even though I have never blogged once.
Why not?
Oh, I don't know. You know, somebody who's been in the business as long as I have, Steve, I think, you know, I'm like a prostitute. I only do it for money.
But no Facebook or Twitter?
I actually have a Facebook fan page, which I've been persuaded to post on once or twice a week. And last week, I took over the Random House at Random Twitter feed for a day and realized both that it was really fun and that it was an epic time suck.
Oh, man.
And therefore, I am not going to be doing it again.
So don't look for Anna Quinlan on Facebook or Twitter then.
I mean, the fan page is on Facebook and it tells you where I'm going to be at any given time on this book tour. But on Twitter, all I could think of was this could ruin my life.
Yeah. Hey, it's been a pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
I will come back to this show anytime.
I hope you will, Anna.
This was so much fun.
I sure appreciate that. That's Anna Quinlan, her new book, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake. She speaks tonight at 7 at Unity Temple on the Plaza. For more information or to grab a seat, call Renee Books in Fairway, 913-384-3126. And speaking of Facebook and Twitter, don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Tomorrow on the program, the political pundits return to look at Missouri, Kansas, and the entire presidential race. We had help today from Danny Alexander, Maria Carter, and Kim Noble. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.